felt like making a personal stand against the implications of coal mining in a world where climate change is a reality was far more important than rugby.
The Sustainable Hour.
For a green, clean, sustainable Geelong, the Sustainable Hour.
Welcome to the Sustainable Hour. Another milestone today, episode number 430. We'd like to acknowledge that we're broadcasting from the land of the Wathaurong people. We're broadcasting from land that was never ceded. That fight for justice goes on today and is very much part of we can't ever have a climate justice until we have justice for our First Nations people. We acknowledge their elders past, present, and those that will earn that great honour in the future. We hope that we learn to appreciate the ancient wisdom that was honed from living on often harsh conditions as they nurtured their land and their communities. And we have so much to learn as we face up to the climate emergency from this ancient wisdom.
Bill White, 67, retired Cheshire England vicar, living in Macclesfield, Cheshire. If you're watching this, it's because I'm in prison. You expect a member of the clergy to stand up for truth and justice, and to do so in a way consistent with the values and principles of Jesus. Being faithful to that calling has led me to where I am now. I would have broken a private law bought from the High Court to protect the oil industry, the industry whose product is killing people today and making lives unlivable in the future. I will not stand by and do nothing in the face of such evil. I've tried reducing my own carbon footprint. It's clear that such personal actions will never be enough. We're all trapped in a life-destroying system created by the powerful to protect their own interests, and we need that system to change if we're to have hope for the future. This leads me and many other ordinary people to make a stand, to risk our freedom and our possessions in the interests of real justice. Our government must stop licensing new fossil fuel extraction.
Amen, Bill White, retired Church of England vicar. Meanwhile, up in Queensland, the Queensland Labor government has approved the expansion now of the Carborough Downs coal mine so that it can, what they call, lift the coal output from 2 million tonnes to 5 million tonnes per year in the entire next decade. You know, how do we take that in when at the same time we read, this is a headline from The Guardian, world on brink of five disastrous climate tipping points. Giant ice sheets, ocean currents and permafrost regions may already have passed point of irreversible change. What is it that our politicians are not getting?
Well, I'll tell you what they are getting. They're getting money from the oil companies.
Yeah.
And that's why they're not taking action. It's as simple as that. It's not complicated, Mick, and we all know it. What we can't do is stop it, apparently.
Yeah. Bill White's trying hard to.
And from jail now.
Yeah, I think it's well, he's inspiring other people, but I think it's worth mentioning, continue to mention those obscene amounts of money that you mentioned 2 or 3 weeks ago, Colin.
Yeah, $4 million a day profit.
Yeah, for 50 years.
But there's good news as well, and this comes from Europe. Just have a listen here to what the leader of the European Union had to say when she gave a long speech last week.
Ursula.
Millions of Europeans need support. This is why we are proposing a cap on the revenues of companies that produce electricity at low costs, These companies are making revenues they never accounted for, they never even dreamt of. And don't get me wrong, in our social market economy, profits are okay, they are good. But in these times, it is wrong to receive extraordinary record revenues and profits benefiting from war and on the back of our consumers. In these times, profits must be shared and channeled to those who need it most. And therefore, our proposal also includes the fossil fuel electricity producers who have to give a crisis contribution. And overall, our proposal will raise more than 140 billion euros for member states to cushion the blow directly.
I opened the news this weekend and it's like heavy rain and major floods all over the world at the moment. And there's a new expression once again. Now they're talking about rain bombs.
Mm. Yes, and a third of Pakistan is underwater and unlikely to dry out in the near future because it's so saturated. It's not draining. Because we've covered this so much over the last month, along with the heat dome in America and in southern Europe, the heat waves, I've left them alone this week. I'm having a bit of a change. Instead, I'm starting with two new reports that coincidentally both feature greenwashing. That's the system of pretending to take environmental action while actually just carrying on as before. We're all aware that our fossil fuel industries and the games that they play when they're bribing politicians to take no action to preserve the oil companies' enormous profits. Well, this week, a joint report from Grain and Friends of the Earth International points out that the global food production in the hands of multinational companies is as practiced at greenwashing as all of them. Behind most of them is the term net zero. Now, according to the UN, those two words mean cutting greenhouse gas emissions as close to zero as possible, with any remaining emissions reabsorbed from the atmosphere. That's what the world's governments all agreed to when they decided to make aim for net zero by 2050. But since then, there's been an avalanche of net zero commitments by multinational corporations. This new report says that almost all of the corporate net zero commitments merely use the term net zero as a way of avoiding cuts to their emissions. They claim that they don't have to cut their emissions that they're actually creating because they can offset them through projects that remove carbon from the atmosphere by planting trees, among many other promises. This, the report says, is just an elaborate fraud. It cites as an example Nestlé and its highly emitting agricultural commodities industries. It actually, you tend to think of Nestlé as making chocolate, but it owns dairy, meat, and other agricultural businesses. And they've promised to cut by two-thirds between 2020 and 2030. They've promised to cut their emissions by two-thirds. But it's all offset. Nestlé has said it will plant trees and conserve forests. But to do this, the report has done the maths. And Nestlé would need to plant over 4 million hectares of tree planting every year just to meet the commitments and the promises they've made. And that's the size of Switzerland, which is where Nestlé is based, of course. What they're basically saying is that the numbers don't add up and they're just making promises for the sake of it. And Nestlé is just one of the hundreds of corporations worldwide saying that they're going to plant trees to get to net zero, while really they're just growing their business. And the second report that was released at the weekend singles out the big multicultural drinks companies, Coca-Cola and Pepsi, as other expert greenwashers. This report is a study commissioned by Oceana and conducted by Eunomia Research and Consulting. And it found that if the top five beverage companies meet all of their pledges to use more recycled plastic in their bottling plants, and it's far from certain that they're going to actually meet these pledges, it would still only reduce aquatic pollution from single-use plastic bottles by 7%. Oceana is calling for major beverage companies to adopt or expand strategies that prioritize refillable bottles, going back to the future, if you like. They also called for governments to bring in legislation that would make the companies pay for their plastic pollution. And in this regard, the US state of Colorado this week adopted a recycling overhaul that switches responsibility from consumers to producers of all packaged goods sold in their state. They estimated that there are 1,500 companies currently offering packaged items in Colorado, but the new law makes companies pay fees to, basically it's a tax that's called the Manufacturer Responsibility Tax, or the Manufacturer Responsibility Fund. And that will support curbside recycling and reuse industries statewide. And it's law. It was passed last Wednesday. And this positions Colorado as the third state in the US after Maine and Oregon that is attacking waste sent to landfills by targeting products and packaging and the companies that produce them. There are other schemes in Canada and Europe, but what makes Colorado different is that it has the support of the majority of those producers. They actually want to get more of their material back and reuse them, because it would establish a system for charging companies less if they design packages and packaging that is easy to recycle. So they're all saying, yes, we'll pay the fund, but we want to get the stuff back so that we recycle it and then we don't have to pay the fund, which is means that they're thinking environmentally. Now to Paris, where they're preparing for the 2024 Olympics, and they're looking to make it the first carbon neutral games. In light of the reports showing how big companies utilize greenwashing, they're also aiming to make all of their efforts transparent. In this regard, they've developed a system for estimating the carbon footprints of just about every element of the big games. This affects the choices that are taken now when they're planning it and throughout the cycle of preparation for the organization. They've brought in a concept that involves using 95% existing or temporary infrastructure. So they're not building things for the future. They're putting up temporary things and they're ensuring that all of their sites are accessible by public transport. They're looking to identify sources of emissions and dedicated low carbon solutions for every activity. All emissions that can't be avoided, such as the international travel by spectators, will be offset by projects designed to bring both that environmental and social benefits from the destination countries. So they're actually getting involved in all five continents. They're aiming to be the first international sporting event that will offset more emissions than it creates. I'll be keeping up with this and making sure that they're keeping up with their promises over the weeks. And this leads to our carbon neutral vegan football team in the UK, the only carbon neutral sporting club. They played Morecambe at their home ground, the New Lawn Stadium, at the weekend, and they lost 1-2. Now, this loss leaves them third from bottom in their new league. If you remember, they were promoted last year. They're in English Division One. And they're just 1 point ahead of the team that beat them, Morecambe. But their team and management are still pretty upbeat and they're confident, Tony, because they're pointing to a string of injuries that left them with just about every fit player on the field at the weekend. So I will keep watching and reporting. And in the meantime, the Forest Green Rovers women's team, who are just as green as their men, kicked off their season with a 2-1 win against Bristol Rovers in Bristol. Now, I'll keep you up to date with their matches too, but for now, that is my roundup for the week.
Listen to our Sustainable Hour for the future.
One initiative that we've come across recently and certainly will follow is The Real Deal. And today we've got Sal Fisher, who is the go-to person on The Real Deal, and Amanda Tattersall from Sydney University in to chat about, to get to find out more about this exciting initiative and what it means for Geelong people.
Yeah, The Real Deal is really trying to work with communities to ensure that they have a voice in the energy and economic transition, which is ahead of us. We know that communities really need to be part of that conversation. And so it's really about trying to build their voice and build power from the ground up so that we can have our say in that transition.
What's that going to look like, and what stage is it at in Geelong?
Yeah, so we're early stages here in Geelong. I've been working on the project since about April, and we're bringing together a variety of different organisations, a diverse coalition of organisations, including the faith groups, unions and community organisations here in Geelong, to come together to discuss this. And, it's been really promising so far. Great involvement from that wide, diverse group of organisations.
What's actually, what are you drawing your inspiration from?
Yeah, so The Real Deal is based on a model which has been operating in several places in Australia. So Amanda was involved in establishing the Sydney Alliance many years ago, and also the Queensland Community Alliance has formed up in southeast Queensland, and they've had lots of successes in winning deals for their community by coming together in this broad alliance of organisations, much more effective in our advocacy when we do that. And Amanda might like to talk about some of the examples of where it's operated in Australia and even beyond.
Sure, happy to come in. Thanks, Sal. So this kind of work has sort of two parents in a way. One is late 2018, 2019, I was working at the Sydney Policy Lab, which is a bridge building institute at Sydney University between the university researchers and community participants, builds research, combining the wisdom of both groups. I was working there and I heard Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez talk about the Green New Deal. And I thought, oh, that sounds interesting. And imagine if we could do something like that in Australia. You know, imagine if we could connect interest in climate change and doing something about climate change, but with a really strong economic base, you know, evoking those ideas of the New Deal and the kind of equality that was attempted coming out of the Depression. You know, imagine if we could do something so big. And so I went to my boss then at the Policy Lab and said, what do you think? Will you provide some initial resources? He said, yeah, that sounds great. Then the idea, we set some stuff up, but the ideas then sat there until the May 2019 election. And in the May 2019 election, there was a lot of interest in climate change, but there was also a lot of challenges in dealing with climate change in fossil fuel communities, where those fossil fuel communities could not see how they were connected to the visions around climate change. A lot of the climate policies were being imposed on them. I'm thinking particularly of Central Queensland. And as a consequence, there was like a blowback where communities went, go away, right? And they voted for climate skeptical candidates because I guess they thought that voting against climate change might stop it. Now, obviously, that wasn't a very sound strategy, but the divisions and the polarizations became really baked into the Australian political system. They were long lasting, but they really were epitomized then. It was after that time in June and after 2019 that we started having a lot of conversations with a lot of different organisations about this idea of what would a Green New Deal look like in Australia. But this is where the second parent of what is now The Real Deal came to bear, which is I am a community organiser as well as an academic at the University of Sydney. And as Sal mentioned, I helped set up the Sydney Alliance, and I work in a tradition of organising that that comes out of Chicago in the 1930s, indeed when the New Deal was developed, set up by Saul Alinsky. And I worked in Sydney Alliance, was one of 98 urban alliances around the world that practice this idea of community organizing. And community organizing talks about building political and policy solutions based on communities' needs and for community leaders to lead them, not to impose them, but for stuff to come from the ground up. And the more I looked into the Green New Deal, while inspiring as it was, a lot of its policy solutions were built by think tanks, progressive think tanks, but think tanks, and they were suggested for the nation. Similar in Canada, not dissimilar in the UK. And I wasn't that interested in doing that kind of thing here. I felt like that's what we'd tried in the 2019 election, which was come up with perfect policy and pushing it down on communities. We didn't need more of that. We needed something that was from the ground up. And that's where the idea of the real deal came from, which was the idea of combining a great strong vision for building significant, necessary political advocacy around the genuine challenge that we face in decarbonisation, combined with community leadership in making it happen. And so the real deal is a participatory policy process from the ground up that builds communities of people like the Sydney Alliance did. You know, I ran the Sydney Alliance for 10 years. Like the Sydney Alliance did, but particularly looking at initially fossil fuel affected communities. And that's why Geelong is a really important place for us, why we're in Gladstone as well, but also climate affected communities. We've built a place-based project in Western Sydney. It's the hottest part of the country. It's damagingly affected by climate change. We've got relationships with the Hunter and Collie, which are also coal communities, but then increasingly now looking at disaster affected communities. Lismore, places, there are lots of places that are directly affected by climate change. And the challenge is not only to come up with solutions that can meet the problem that we face in terms of a heating planet, but also to ensure that people are at the center of those policies, helping to guide them. Because if people aren't guiding the change, then the policies get stuck. And we know what that looks like in Australia. We want to avoid that. So that's what we're doing with the project.
I think this sounds amazing, Amanda, because isn't it like the biggest problem of them all that we have when we talk about climate change is that we each as individuals feel powerless. Everyone is saying, well, what can I do? I'm too small. It's not going to make a big difference anyway. And because everyone is saying that at the moment, you know, we're not coming together as a community and dealing with the problem. So getting the community on the same page seems to be like the first step we need to take. And to me, the big question is, how do you do it then?
Well, I mean, Sal can run you through what's been happening in Geelong broadly, but I'll run you through the theory and then Sal can tell you how it runs on the ground, because it's great to actually have this happening in a place like Geelong. But the approach is to one of the central tenets of community organizing, and when we apply it as researchers, we call it the relational method, is to say that relationships need to precede action. And so what we do is we start by connecting with a community, and we connected to Geelong in part through the United Workers Union, which was part of our national network of organisations. And they were saying, we need to do something in Geelong. We've got all these workers at the oil refineries. They're going to lose their jobs. How can we create a transition that works as opposed to a transition that actually ends up dumping and running on the workers? It's happened before in Geelong. We need to do it differently. And so we connected through them to Geelong. But the theory is you start with relationships, and not just relationships with one kind of organization, relationships with lots of different ones. So the climate movement has a weakness, you know, you could say, in that it's often middle class, it's often white, it's often inner city. Now, that's beautiful. We want those people to be active, but it's not enough. It's not enough to win. And there's plenty of people who worry about climate change, but they've got other justice concerns, whether they're economic or cultural or social justice concerns that are also part of the sort of their daily life. And so the relationships and listening process is about connecting with lots of different organizations who might not put climate in their title. You know, the Uniting Church doesn't necessarily walk around and say, we're a climate organization, but their people care about climate change. And so we build those relationships, same with unions, same with climate groups and environment groups. We want them involved as well. But this diversity, this network of diversity has its own power, because people start learning about each other's interests. We start to actually understand that the oil workers at the refineries in Geelong, for instance, or the coal train drivers in Gladstone, have genuine concerns, some of which are connected to climate change, some of which are not connected to climate change, are around jobs and training. And we need to respond to both of those concerns, all of those concerns, as we build really genuinely powerful policies around transition. So that's, so the first is relationships and listening. We then move to research and action. So what are we going to do about it, right? What is our industry plan? What are our solutions to these enormous problems? And instead of having, look, we have lots of academics involved in the project, but they're not there coming in telling everyone about all their brilliant wisdom. They're there to listen and work with teams of people from the community to come up with solutions. So academics can bring some of that specialized technical knowledge that, you know, isn't necessarily easy to access if you're in a community and worried, but you can exchange and learn to come up with policy solutions. Then those communities are able to not just write a policy document, they can then work together to take public action, to negotiate and explore policy solutions with the relevant decision makers, whether they be local people in Geelong or national decision makers, whatever is necessary. The real deal, in a sense, is lots of deals. We don't think that there's one magic solution, right? We might negotiate with the school to get more solar panels. We might negotiate with the council to get more something else. We might negotiate with the housing provider to get five-star affordable housing, right? And then we evaluate, we learn, and then we do it all again. That's the process. But it's happening now on the ground with Sal.
Yeah, so what we're doing here locally in Geelong, I kicked off basically with a lot of one-to-one relational meetings with leaders to find out their interest and passion, you know, whether they want to be involved in this project. We started to form an alliance. So we've been meeting regularly now, about every 2 weeks we get together. And we're about to kick off what we call a listening process here in Geelong. So we've conducted our first training for the leaders involved with the project so far. The listening process will involve what we call table talks. So we'll invite people from our organisations to come in and have a conversation with us around this issue of economic transition. So we talk to them about what's happened in the past in Geelong with economic transition, how that was managed, how that, you know, the impacts of that economic transition, because we know in Geelong we've had some pretty dramatic transitions with huge impacts for people here, which, you know, worked out okay for some people, but not so well for a lot of people. So we need to learn from those experiences and hear those stories. Then we'll start talking about what's life like now for you at the moment? What are your struggles and challenges in Geelong at the moment? We know that people have a lot on their plate, and so we want to hear those stories. And then we want to talk about what's coming. We know that, you know, climate change is going to have an impact upon us. We know it's going to impact our energy systems. It's going to require a significant transformation of our society. So we want to hear what people's dreams and aspirations are for that, and the opportunities that we can benefit from that transition here in Geelong. Because, you know, we it's not necessarily all a negative thing. You know, there's lots of things, good things that can come out of this transformation and this transition. We want to make sure that Geelong's proactive about that, so that we see those opportunities land here in our city. And once we finish that listening process, then we will then go through what we call that discernment process. So, you know, we'll go back, our leaders will look at this, all of these conversations, and we'll pick out what we think are the priorities for us to focus on, so that we can then advocate to our politicians here more effectively and together, and hopefully have some wins out of this.
Yeah, look, I'm very much aware that the New Deal that you use as your model it was Roosevelt's way out of the huge Great Depression of the 1930s, and it was driven by government. He put in new projects that were building everything from dams to highways and things, but it came from the top down. It strikes me that the new real deal that you're pushing is very much the opposite. It's coming from the community upwards. Have you got any communications with government, which at the moment, it strikes me, they're the ones who are dragging their feet, even though we've changed our government? And it was very clearly that the election where we changed our government earlier this year, was very much a climate change one, where the teal independents got in. But the winning changed government still pretty much is keeping to the steady as you go and not doing anything radical, which is what you are saying we should be doing.
Mm. So yes, we don't have a Roosevelt in Parliament, do we? And so what do we need to do to create the conditions for political change? And in a sense, it's our theory of change, which is, you know, we can complain about it, but that's actually not going to produce the change. The reason why they're not acting is not because they're bad people. I think they're not acting because there is not a political constituency of people to allow more interesting and creative forms of action. And in particular, it's not just about not acting because they don't want to. I actually don't think that they have the mix of policy solutions because they're not involving the right people in policy development. And what we say is that work is actually a bit tricky and requires a bit of time. And often the climate movement is so racked with urgency, very understandable urgency because of the climate crisis that we're in, that we shortcut the policy process and the process of involving people in the change that we seek. And lots of people are doing lots of different forms of climate action. Some people are acting fast and swiftly and differently and all over the place. And we love the fact that there's this really robust ecosystem of climate action in Australia and around the world. Our contribution is a little bit more of the tortoise in some of these communities that where if we don't involve people in the process of change, we will never get more interesting political action from this government, from any government, it would seem. If we can't work out a way that allows for, we need to build the constituency to be broader in order to expect more action. Because I think that there are lots of people who are panicked and frustrated about the lack of climate action, but there's also an enormous number of people for whom this is not a top issue. And we need to engage those people, that sort of broader constituency of people, into the change process in order to be able to create the kind of pressure upon the political leaders in Australia.
Exactly. Last week, someone wrote, in the light of our current situation, you might say, if you're not depressed, you're probably out of touch. People are blocking out all the bad news, deliberately out of touch, and we need to find a way to open up that door, as you say.
Yeah, this has been good news, Mick, in that it allows a community to grow, it empowers a community, individuals within a community to become part of a community and chart the course of their future, which is really empowering, as I see it. If the community doesn't talk, something in fear is going to be imposed on it. There's no better community than the community members to talk about what should happen in Geelong in the future and have that input. And really, the pollies they've got no idea. The script isn't written and they're really scared to come up with ideas. So if the community comes to them and says, we've got this, if they want to stay in power, their constituents are coming to them. It gives them power to talk within their party machines to say, this is what my constituents are saying. I don't think there's too many politicians that would go against that. So it's, you know, it's everything to win in it, in the process.
Have a listen here to Kevin Anderson. He's a professor of energy and climate change at the University of Manchester.
There is no non-radical alternative. We either have to deal with 3 to 5 degrees centigrade of warming, which is a radically different world from the one we live in today, that will occur in a sort of ecosystem point of view, just overnight, you know, across this century, you know, by the end of the century, it could be 3 to 5 degrees warmer if we just carry on failing like today. And that will mean radical change. And it will be chaotic radical change. Or we reduce our emissions at such a rapid rate that also means radical change. But unpick that a little bit more, and it's radical change for who? The equity part is key within countries, not just between countries. In a country like the UK, a highly unequal society, most of the emissions will come from a small percentage of the population. At a global level, half the world's emissions come from the activities of about 10% of the population. That will hold for a country that's as unequal as is the UK. So here, it's not radical change for everyone. It's radical change for 10 to 20, possibly as much as 30%. But the other majority of the population will see incremental, significant change, but not a fundamental radical change to how they're living their lives. Most people in the UK are relatively low emitters. The problem is that most of the people who are the high emitters are the climate scientists, the barristers, the journalists, the policymakers, the entrepreneurs, the business leaders. All the people that develop the framing, the policies for to deal with climate change are the high emitters. And they are very reluctant to develop policies that require radical, profound changes to how they are living, how we are living. We are not prepared to accept what our own science and analysis tell us about the sorts of levels of change that we require. And let's remember, we require the changes now because we have chosen to fail for 30 years.
There's lots of evidence in every single space that the more diverse the decision makers and the participants are, whether it's business to community to policy to politics, the better they are. And I guess that's our modus operandi. We're saying there just aren't enough people deciding climate policy in Australia. You know, we've got lots of, you know, people with research expertise, which actually I don't have a problem with. Like I want great climate scientists. I want great industry leaders to come up with creative solutions. I just want them to do it with other people who actually live in the communities that are going to be affected by the policies they develop. I don't want it power over the imposition of ideas, because it always comes with blowback and backlash it has a deficit, right? Mm. It has a deficit because it doesn't involve the people whose lives need to be taken into consideration as these policies develop, and actually whose ideas and inspiration will craft the best policies anyway.
So where does that position the citizens' assembly idea, which is something we've been excited about when we heard about the idea first, and then it's been tried out in England and in France and places? Where do you see that?
So look, I'm, you know, a thousand flowers bloom, right? Like I'm all for lots of trying all things. The thing about a citizens' assembly is I do research on social change strategy, and I contrast forms of people power, right? Different forms of people power. And a citizens' assembly approach is a mobilizing approach to change. You bring lots of people who are hopefully diverse together. You send out the invite, people come in, and people participate. It's great, you know, an Athenian polis. The difficulty is that not a lot of effort is taken in mobilizing strategies about who's in the room. So it tends to be the kind of people who can get themselves in the room or who want to be in the room. The kind of people who are more pressured by other issues other than climate change might not be in the space. So there's a limit, right, to that approach to people power. What we're doing with the Real Deal is a different approach to people power called organizing. And organizing focuses on cultivating leaders and creating a broad-based constituency involved in change. And it involves organizations like churches and unions and community organizations who we see as mini democracies, mini democratic hubs. And the beauty of a union or a church is they don't go away, right? In 2 years, in 5 years, in 10 years, these institutions are still going to be there, and they're going to be battling with the challenges that we face. They have greater longevity, right? The Sydney Alliance, we started that 15 years ago, and it is robust as ever. But there's not a lot of social movements that have that same longevity. So it's just a different model. The organizing model that the Real Deal is using is just a different approach to citizens' assemblies. They're not in competition. Indeed, in the book that I'm putting out on this topic, we talk about how you need all of these things, and it's about building an architecture that allows these different forms of people power to connect and harness their different strengths. But yeah, it's what we're doing is not dissimilar. It's involving people. It's just a different approach to how they get involved.
So there is a time aspect in this, because you seem to be very patient. I think a lot of us and a lot of climate activists feel that we are in a hurry. We've heard the leading scientist in the UK say that it's within the next, and he said this 2 years ago, so he's basically saying within the next year, decisions are made that are going to decide how our future is going to play out for humanity for thousands of years.
Yep. And you know what? 12 years ago, I started conversations with the climate movement about community organizing and relational organizing. And people told me that they were too much in a rush to be able to do it. And, you know, I keep thinking that if only we had been doing it, we would be 12 years ahead. I mean, look, it would have been great to start this organizing, this more intentional and slower organizing process earlier. But the second best time to start it is now. And we're not saying that everyone in the climate movement needs to work at this slow and more deliberate pace. It just needs to exist in the lexicon. It needs to be part of the way in which the movement grows, because no rapid fire urgent organizing is at the moment connecting to new constituencies of people. But new constituencies of people need to be involved in the process of working out what's happening with climate and economic transition for it to be successful. We see that as our contribution to the space.
But do we need some new words then? Because it seems like just the word climate makes everyone exhausted.
Well, we don't necessarily think that we're going to be talking about every policy change is going to have the word climate in it. But, you know, that doesn't mean that it's not a climate policy, right? Like changes to encourage people to use public transport and use less cars is a climate policy, but it doesn't kind of have the word climate in it, right? Like there's lots of different ways that you can talk about climate in relation to justice and people's daily living that, you know, to use Naomi Klein, like if it changes everything, if climate change, then it changes all of our approaches to everything that we do. Therefore, everything is a climate policy to an extent. And we think that that is best understood and built through these broad-based networks on the ground in communities like Geelong.
So if we, our listeners, something concrete that they can follow up, the trainings maybe in October, is that a good start?
Yeah, I would love to have people attend our next training session. We'll be running that in the evening on Thursday, the 6th of October. People can register for that through our website, which is www.arealdeal.org. And there's a Geelong page there with details about the training there where people can sign up. So, yeah, the more the merrier. Yeah, particularly for Geelong people to come along and participate in that, that'd be fantastic.
And what happens after, in a way, what are they committing to by attending that cell? What, so they'll be trained to do the table talks?
That's right, yeah. So then they'll be involved with, we've got, as I said, a number of community organisations that we can tap into their members to have these conversations around the table. That they can occur in people's homes, they can happen in cafes, they can happen in community centres, these organisations that we're working with in our alliance here in Geelong.
Any take-home messages? Just last thing from either of you about your excitement around this initiative?
For me, I guess, I think it's just really heartening to be involved with this diverse, you know, bunch of people that we've been working with to have these conversations with people from the union movement. You think pretty much the same as I do about, you know, what needs to happen here in Geelong. It's really exciting to have those conversations. And I think it gives me a lot of hope for our future here that we can make these decisions and be more involved in, you know, what happens here in Geelong and have our say.
Dealing with the crisis of climate change also needs to be a moment where we deal with the crisis in our democracy. It needs to be a time where we can provide spaces and opportunities for more people to have a say about the world in which we live and how it can be better. You know, too often, we sort of leave too many decisions to a bunch of decision makers who might try very hard, but they are unable to deliver the kind of change that we need because they're not listening to the people on the ground. And that's only going to change if people like us, you know, people who just have pretty normal jobs and pretty normal lives are involved in helping to shape how we deal with big crisis. No expert, even all the smartest experts in the room, know the solutions to this. We're going to create them as we go. And who's in the room? If people like us are in the room, it means that the solutions will help and advance our interests too. Only having people who have apparent expertise speaking means that turns people off. I think that what is important is that we don't just have scientists. This is not just a STEM debate. This is a social science discussion as well. And we need to have people involved and invested in the climate solutions. We've known the science for decades and it hasn't changed the politicians. People change the politicians. We need to bring more people into the discussion. I think really that's what's missing.
The climate crisis is heavily weighing in our bills. Heat waves have boosted electricity demand. Droughts shut down hydro and nuclear plants. And as a result, prices have risen by more than 10 times compared to before the pandemic. Making ends meet is becoming a source of anxiety for millions of businesses and households in the European Union.
this climate crisis. It's a critical time in our planet. A lot of people understand the problem, but they do nothing because they feel helpless. Because so what if I pick up trash? So what if I turn off taps? So what if I think about making ethical choices in my shopping? So what? If it was just me, it wouldn't make any difference at all. But it's not true. We're beginning to do better. Hope is contingent upon our taking action together soon. All of us, every single one of us, we've all got to do our bit. We've got to act together. We've got to act together fast.
Greenhouse gas concentration, sea level rise, and ocean heat have broken new records. Half of humanity is in the danger zone from floods, droughts, extreme storms, and wildfires. No nation is immune. Yet we continue to feed our fossil fuel addiction. We cannot continue this way. We must rebuild trust and come together to keep 1.5 alive and to build climate-resilient communities. We need to move forward together on all fronts. We have a choice, collective action or collective suicide. It is in our hands.
Humanity now has a wicked problem. The intertwined nature emergency with the social post-pandemic high inflation and inequality emergencies. Since 1980, the fraction going to the top 10% incomes have skyrocketed. We expect inequality to get ever worse going forward to 2050, drawing down the long-term average human well-being.
The greatest existential risk to humanity is not acting now on the social and environmental tipping points that we are already seeing. We don't only see tipping points in the ecological space, but also clear social tipping points, as has been very well described, which are getting increasingly aggravated, as we are seeing today, by the health pandemic, the Ukrainian crisis, and so many other conflicts across the globe, as well as, obviously, the climate crisis. Access to food, energy, material scarcity, pricing, and obviously the increase in energy poverty are what is going to be our demise if we do not act. The tipping points and the current crises are also a reflection of what we describe of a dysfunctional society.
I believe we all came to be here for a reason. To acknowledge the seniors, everything has a season. This season is warm, but it's bringing a storm and a burning urge for our journey to transform. But held in our hand at this grave intersection is a map of the passage for a clearer direction to a permanent culture. It's time we began it with some wise design to realign with the planet. Share skills to rebuild our combined reliance. And with wild guidance, redesign our diet. Befriend energy descent and the change in climate. To grow forests of food and a finer environment. Permaculture at this tumultuous juncture is a superstructure that can plug the puncture. In a society of anxiety, confusion and greed, this really may be one solution we need to bring back our elementary essence of ethics and walk in earth care, people care, fair share epic. Now's the time to embed it while the temperature's tepid. Let us rise as a choir beside the people who get it to guarantee that our future generations' lives are provided the conditions they require to thrive instead of being deprived of the tools to survive in a biosphere too defiled to revive. So we invite you now to amplify the synergy, devise and inspire distinctive soliloquy, combining with like minds an adaptable symphony of radical simplicity, balance and symmetry. Whatever your ability, we need your assistance. In aid of reclaiming a stable existence, go summon your gift at this critical hour and deliver wherever they move and empower.
I think it's probably time now to change the politicians. until we find politicians that are progressive thinkers.
Well, I think that that's stunning, right? Like when I look at the Teal Independents, I think, wow, there's a whole bunch of impressively brilliant women who were doing pretty normal things. I mean, some of them were very successful, but they were being journalists, they were being doctors, and they decided that enough is enough and they needed to find a place in political life. Well, that having more people in political life who can speak for the complexity of life and the demands of science, I think that's probably is what we need.
Along with the Teal politicians was another revolution that happened, a political revolution, and that was the decline of the two major parties. And I think that is the thing that is going to change politics in Australia. We will get more Teal type independent thinking people, and they're the people that we need. And we have to get away from the rigid thinking of the two main parties.
And I'd say that, so when I talk about people power strategies, like I identify five, I talked about two, mobilising and organising, but the fifth is parties. And around the world, in the places where the most interesting and creative political change is occurring, and I'm thinking Barcelona, but I'm thinking also South America and parts of Europe, often at
Scandinavia.
Across Europe, there's a lot of interesting stuff happening, and it's happening where there's this intersection between mobilising, organising, prefigurative demands, creative playing by the rules, and a change in party politics. And when all of those things start to happen, interesting things start to happen in terms of policy change.
Terrific. Amanda, really good, really pleased to hear that you've got a book coming out in the very near future. Can we be part of your book tour when it hits the streets?
Oh, look, it's like a glacial expedition, but as soon as it comes out, when it comes out, I would be delighted to come back on.
You're on.
We have to move rapidly. What we do over the next 3 to 4 years, I believe, is going to determine the future of humanity.
The scientific conclusion as we meet today in 2022 is that planet Earth is changing faster, even faster than science could predict. In fact, the risk is no longer to have millions of people affected by climate change and billions of US dollars being lost. No, today the risk assessment shows that we have a risk of billions of people being affected and trillions of US dollars being lost. We're talking real risk for the whole world economy. Tipping points, science now shows, are at risk already at 1.5 degrees Celsius. Irreversible, unstoppable changes. 6 of 9 planetary boundaries are transgressed. We are moving along a very dangerous path. Risks are now rising of ecological collapse, which may make an equal or an equity-based future impossible. We have today evidence that we cannot reach the Sustainable Development Goals unless we transition in a sustainable fashion.
If we continue on our current path, we will face the collapse of everything that gives us our security. Food production, access to fresh water, habitable ambient temperature, and ocean food chains. And if the natural world can no longer support the most basic of our needs, then much of the rest of civilization will quickly break down. Please make no mistake. Climate change is the biggest threat to security that modern humans have ever faced.
Every single one of us matters. Every single one of us has some role to play.
The bottom line, isn't it, that we need to change the story in our society. Coal, oil, and gas is not good for us. And the minute people don't want to buy gas and they don't want to get coal into their country, that's when the drilling and the seismic testing will stop, because nobody wants to buy those dirty fossil fuels.
Mm.
So there is that long journey there that the real deal is all about changing the story from bottom up.
Yeah.
I mean, we have research coming out. Oxford University is telling us that the world would be saving as much as $17 trillion. There's so many zeros behind that, you know, it's so many dollars that would be saved if we switched from fossil fuels to renewable energy. So we are being conned by, you know, not just the fossil fuel people who are selling us this stuff, but by our governments and by the media who are not telling us this. Why is that not headline news? We can save $17 trillion by switching from fossil fuels to renewable energy. That should be on top of everybody's mind.
Well, we know who controls the media. That's controlled by Rupert Murdoch, and he's controlled by the fossil fuel industry.
So I think we have a mission of changing the story. Yep. And that begins with every one of us.
Yep.
Imagine if the media were saying every time there was a new event, a climate disruption out there in the world, they were saying this is fossil fuel climate change.
Yeah.
You know, if the word fossil fuel was connected to these events every time.
Well, it's got to start somewhere. Why don't we start?
Exactly. So let's rename climate change to fossil fuel climate change.
Yep.
And that's the way we can be the difference.
Oh, yep.
Be the difference.
Be the difference.
Be the difference. Be the difference. Be the difference. I know the world's gone mad. It's true. Be the difference. Be the difference. 'Cause I see a fighter logged in.
This report doesn't tell us what to do. It doesn't say you have to do this and then you have to do this. It doesn't provide us with such solutions or tell us that you need to do this. And that's up for us. We are the ones who need to take the decisions, and we are the ones who need to be brave and ask the difficult questions to ourselves, like what do we value? So am I gonna open everything? Am I gonna let fury fill my cup? Am I gonna be an anthem singing in the dark? Gonna light up like a burning heart? Am I gonna stand still as a rock while everything shakes and tumbles off? Am I gonna remember the truth? 'Cause I wanna be nasty, wanna be brave, not let his fear make me afraid. I don't wanna pretend I'm too small to jump the wall. I'm just trying to remember her voice, telling me that every day's a choice for where there's good, there's bad. But my child, you always can be the difference.
Hello, I'm Chloe Naldret. I'm a 42-year-old theatre producer from Bristol. I'm a mother of two children. If you're watching this video, I'm in prison. And I'm in prison because of action that I have consciously taken as part of a campaign of civil resistance against this government, because of their mishandling of the climate and cost of living crisis and their refusal to mobilise behind renewable energy and home insulation, which would be part of the solution to both of those problems. I've taken this action alongside a great number of ordinary people like me, doctors, social workers, farmers, students, vicars, retired teachers, all of whom who have been prepared to stand up at this moment and say that we will not accept the trading of our children's futures for short-term profit. I know that some of my family and friends will find this distressing, and that they will think that this is a really extreme thing to do. Antonio Guterres, the Secretary General of the UN, has said that the real extremists are the governments and the big energy companies who are continuing to pursue fossil fuel projects in full knowledge of what that's doing to our future. I need to say to you all that I'm okay. I've done this with a huge amount of support, including the support of Joe and my boys. And I know exactly what I'm doing and why. If you'd like to support me further, please share this video. Step into a conversation with your family and friends about why someone you know has gone to prison. And please look up Just Stop Oil so that you can see more about this campaign of civil resistance that thousands of people are joining in with. Please join us in Westminster from the 1st of October. We can have no new oil. Please, for the sake of our children and our futures, this is the time to step forward and join us.
This is Carl. Don't be afraid. Don't be scared.
We are the land of droughts and flooding rains. We recognise that. It is a very volatile and often capricious climate.
At the heart of this conflict is a battle between truth and science and power and lies.